794 Sorge Tune 21 2008 Spectra 3.3 usability testing of websites 1. Alright, so I assembled a good many of materials in here, and we will look at some of them and have a whole series of reading. So page 6970 is just a general outline for evaluating internet resources in I'm going to go over that outline briefly. But what's the purpose? Who will use the evaluation? Will it be yourself or somebody else? And then there's the question, will it be a primary source? So are you actually going to... The primary and secondary source, the distinction is a primary source you actually get answers from. A secondary source you just get pointers to where the answer may be found. And so clearly, if it's a primary source, a validity of information is important. You really need to make sure that the facts given there are correct, or that you trust them to have checked it completely. And how important is it to have it right? Okay, websites can be distinguished by many types. Page 70. And they may make a difference for the evaluation. And some may be more germane to others than others. So if you have an image or a sound document, the evaluation criteria are quite different from a scientific article. And there may be a scientific article. So there's just so many types of documents on the web that each has their own characteristics. And what we will talk about later on is mainly sort of the prototypical website, and not a PDF document. It's just the same as paper document, with the website of a company or the website of a project and things like that. The subject field may make a difference. The criteria of the for the evaluation, we're going to focus on usability criteria, but that's only one piece. Page 71 following gives you a long list of things one could look at in web pages. And actually, some of them are just criteria for evaluating any kind of document. And then at the end, there are some that are web-specific. Page 78 starts web-specific.
When we're looking at evaluation of internet resources, do you mean like software that's available?
No, website evaluation.
Okay.
The 3.3 and 3.4, but website evaluation. Primarily from the point of view of usability. Okay. So what I went through right here was just sort of a very short general overview of website evaluation. Period. That you might find in a reference course. That you might want to teach 10th graders about.
So it's not from the point of view of finding research about software,
not at all. It's just evaluating websites.
Okay, I get it.
that's the resources for finding software information we talked about earlier. That's a different, topic. So I'm skipping ahead to page 80, which just is sort of by way of illustration, the same usability criteria that are listed for software are also listed for web pages. This may be just a little bit varied. Actually, just read through those because they're really adapted to the web. It is actually tweaked, and some are new and some are tweaked to looking at websites or documents in general rather than looking at software. Notice that indicate similar concepts with identity terminology is advice you don't learn an English composition. They tell you to vary the language, which is actually poor advice for technical documents or even for other documents. To use different terms for the same thing for the sake of variation may be more confusing than useful. Okay, so now I like to steal other people's slide presentations. And this is 1999, but I keep looking around, and this is still the best I found for so this is usability inspections, which is the method we saw in software, here applied to the web. And they give you some criteria on slide 3 of 27. Well, there are some websites that don't go away if you close them. They're trying to, in their...
Resize your windows, that's what I hate.
Yeah.
To resize your window.
Yeah. Or vice versa.
But you see some side notes here with the needed. If the website is really needed, it may be used even if it's awful. Mm-hmm. But if you have an e-commerce, well, I mean, most e-commerce sites have competition. So they may not be really needed. And if it's just takes too long, then you go someplace else. And as you point out, the organization may affect trust. So if you want to design a website that people trust, then it better be well organized.
And professional looking. You almost expect something that's trustworthy to be slick looking now. It doesn't necessarily go both ways, but you expect a certain type of typeface and formatting. And
Right. I mean, it's too slick, it may be. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no empirical evidence for saying that, so maybe I shouldn't. But yes, certainly layout can affect trust. I mean, if it's done looking very amateurish, then that the people, the reader might think the content is also amateurish.
Look at the empty smiley faces in the corner.
So the bottom slide there on that page is about why one should worry about usable websites. And the user mistakes comes in for websites that collect data from the user. Okay, now sometimes it's good for these. I remember, I think it was Hungarian Airlines I wanted to get a ticket for, and it took me 3 attempts to actually get my ticket. But for some reason, every attempt to make the ticket cheaper. So if the website has been really, if the website had been really perfect, I would have paid for the expensive ticket. But normally you don't want that. I mean, you don't want to have CSM. For example, you don't want to get data to go away. If something was mistaken, they come back, and sometimes that happens. Even the United Airlines side, I think, for international check-in, online check-in, if you make some mistake and just start over, and all the data you put in is gone, it's start over. It's not good usability. Okay, so, and please chime in with any comments you have, and I guess I have to look at these slides, they're usually self-explanatory. And so if you have questions or comments, just chime in. So we're now looking at slide 5 of 27. These slides are well done with icons and you don't really need to hear the person talk to them. That's no comment on this one. Okay, so the next one. I think that one speaks for itself as well. All right, so now we talk about individual methods. I am now on slide 7. So this is all in the what he called inspections and reviews, which is not user testing, just going through and they are now, I mean, he has several subtitles. If you have an expert look at it, and tell people what's good or bad about the website.
It's mentions just a usability expert, but if you had a website or something on a specific, I don't know, topic or, I mean, would it like a subject expert or something like that be useful as well?
Absolutely. No. Again, he is focusing on usability. Oh yeah, actually, you. This is problematic because this was not in the This was not typed. This was just copied. And so, okay, let me talk a little more than I would usually do.
It's okay.
So among the inspections we use, yes, expert evaluation. And it was just suggested that, I mean, this focuses on usability, sort of the superficial, not in a bad sense, but if you will, clearly that evaluation also needs to do with content. So you might also have a subject expert look at the website to make sure the content is correct. But that's a different, there are two separate pieces. However, they do interact.
Well, maybe subject expert isn't the best way to describe it, but not even thinking of content, but you have someone, I don't know, who can give you feedback based on like their interaction with users. I'm thinking about like librarians who might be able to give you some feedback on how they've seen users, which would be less expensive and less time consuming than actual users, so maybe a little easier to do. Not as good as having actual users test it, but I mean, like that sort of expert that might talk about the kind of tasks instead of different.
Get a different kind of expert than a usability expert.
I guess it depends on the way you define usability expert.
A usability expert with a knowledge base about your user set.
Right.
If you wanted to look at a website that was geared for school kids, you'd much rather have a school librarian or a teacher review it than having a usability expert from finance, software, industry review it. So I don't know where that fits in here, but you know, an expert who is knowledgeable about your user base.
Yeah, right.
A huge difference.
Yeah, I think. I mean, they may not know the term usability and know that that's kind of what they're doing, but they could be useful.
But I mean, the content and the presentation clearly need to interact. So there may be grouping. There may be colors used. That a content expert would advise different groupings or even different colors because in a history website there may be historic colors. Different combating parties may have had different colors. So clearly then in the color scheme of the websites where you sort of talk about one part and the other, you want to use the historic colors. The usability expert could tell you the contrast is good, but he couldn't tell you that this faction used blue and this faction was used red. And so you may need a subject expert as well. Informal developer walkthrough is just the same thing done by the developers. And if there are several developers, then they may discuss it. But that's still sort of I would have problems with that because of the last difficulty mentioned here. You did it, so you may find out in your own work, but you're less likely than somebody else to. What would be the best way to combine the advantages of expert evaluation and informal developer walkthroughs?
Have the expert and the developer walkthrough together?
Yes.
As long as you're obvious. Tactile. Well, that's one reason why Dan Alone has me do 508 compliance testing. I don't know anything about the website. They just say, here, go look at it. What's it look like to you? Can you do it? They've got a live specimen there now.
Okay.
Are you a test user or a guinea pig? How do you take that?
They're testing out a new website type thing for electronic health records, and I felt like a guinea pig that day. Nothing was working.
Okay.
And the engineer was sitting there with me watching it happen. I'm going, help! He couldn't even help.
Yeah, I see.
But other sites, they can give me, let me alone, and I just give them a report because I can make it through it. I don't have to watch me.
It may still be more productive than watch you. It may be more expensive,
yep,
but also more productive.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could see your slight hesitation,
yep,
at the point where you eventually get through.
Yeah,
it may not show up in your report.
The comment about, you know, good idea, obvious good idea is to have the developer and the expert go through it together, except that in the real world, the developer's usually in California and the expert's usually in Boston.
Yeah.
Teleconferencing.
Yeah, you can.
Absolutely.
That helps, and you can communicate. But having your experts and developers in the same geographic area is problematic.
But it's not necessary anymore. You have the technology to do it almost like if they were sitting in the same room. And they can look at the same screen, they can do the same things, they can see each other.
And you have to do it thinking out loud.
Yeah,
on the phone. So.
Yeah.
It forces them to do that.
So they will talk to each other anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the heuristic evaluation is really the same except a little more systematic. Because you should then really look at the heuristics. If the expert evaluators and developers have the heuristics in their mind, it would be better anyway. But I mean, you might sort of use the heuristics almost like a checklist for individual features.
And you were right about being screwed. I got to a point at one of them, and I came up, and three go buttons were coming up after the enter the search box. I'm like, why do they need three go buttons? And here there was only one on the screen, but for some reason my screen reader was reading three. I'm like, okay, something's wrong with the program.
Yes.
And they were able to see it, but I wasn't. And that's why having them there was a good idea.
Right. Contrary to the last bullet here, I think you could do heuristic evaluation with a scenario. Just go through with a task and have heuristic principles in the cognitive walkthrough. You really need to know what cognitive theory they are talking about. In the pluralistic usability walkthrough, that's where all of them walk through it. So this is the group walk. So we sort of talk about that when we said put the expert and the developer together into a walkthrough. That would be an example of a pluralistic walkthrough. And a lot of these walkthroughs, of course, depend on the ability of the people who do it, because to some extent you should not only see whether what there is good, you should also be able to say, wait a minute, this could be done better. The better is the enemy of the good, and evaluation always has to compare with something. And so a person who is at the same time designer or at least has a design ability can come up with better ways to do things. The drawing design walkthrough in the main difference here that it's a paper holotype rather than, but actually for any of the methods we just talked about, there's a question, do you apply them just to paper? You could apply this to paper markups. You could apply this to a markup on the screen. You could accept, then you couldn't put any button. You just look at the screen, there is a button, and this happened and see the next book. You could apply it to your prototype, or you could apply it to the real thing. In web design, prototypes are obviously easier to do than in software, particularly if you have a good web design and creation, web page creation program. It should be very easy to make changes. You could actually make changes on the fly while the people walk through. Yeah, I mean, if it says this yellow stands out too much, make it more what's the name, pastel like. They could just go in, pick a different color for that area, and in half a minute, and so they could change it as it happens. Okay, now what does the next slide tell us? Gives us lots of percentages of things found, presumably.
It's going to say the experts are better at finding them.
Experts are better at finding what?
Finding all kinds of errors.
Errors, problems, potential problems, annoyances.
Actual noise, confusion, yeah. Causes error, causes failure.
Usability experts, not developers. They have developers and usability experts separated.
Are too close to that stuff by the time they're done developing it. They're
attached to it. Yeah, experts. They're referring to usability experts.
Yeah, it would be nice to know what the overlap is. Your experts and developers.
I would think that if you had a developer that isn't working on that particular project so much, I think they would have a higher percentage of finding errors and so forth than a developer that's working on that project all the time.
We don't know where these numbers come from.
Oh,
we don't know whether these are, I suspect these were the developers working on the project. So there's expert review, and then the next slide has similar ways of usefulness, and the expert review found 150 problems, cognitive walkthrough found 40, and developer guidelines, which is sort of heuristic evaluation, your guidelines, is found 75. I mean, you can take the heuristic heuristics and make a 100-page developer guideline, which says, I mean, there are some things that are now very standard. Like if you have a list from which you can select one, you use the radio button. If you use a list from which you can select multiple, you use a little square, a little checkbox. And if that's violated, that can easily be seen, right? And that's of course bad. The next slide, 13, talks about collaborative usability inspections, which seems to be very similar to the pluralistic walkthrough. Except that it's a little more systematic. And then the slide 14 gives sort of an overall process. Usability inspection. So the previous rules and competing sites are things to look at, to compare with. This is actually something that didn't show up in any of the previous ones, that you may want to do, if you have an e-commerce site under development, you may want to look at the competitor site also. And go subject them to an inspection, which will do, you will find errors to avoid and good ideas to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's a good thing to do. So, but there the next step to a requirements model, a task model, which is more specific. You might have five tasks, and for each you have sort of a series of steps that need to be done to complete it, what kind of information is needed to complete it. And then you start developing prototypes, wire diagrams, or the wireframes. You could, for websites, it's easier to make prototypes, easier than for software. I think you have actual working prototype, an internal release, which is just for people to look at and finally have a finished system. And for this guy, paper prototype, working prototype, internal release, and beta release are the best places to do the inspection. Clearly, the finished system is too late. And actually should be done early in the process. All right, slide 15 gives some interesting viewpoints about so magic leaves it or not, but this focuses very heavily on usability defects, finding them as many as possible, as quickly as possible. And he says it's not for designing, discussing, or debating, and I think that point is debatable. You may well find design suggestions. So, I think the reason that it's not for designing is time. So, what one may want to do if people have design suggestions, they note them. Maybe only to themselves. If you have a collaborative usability inspection, the collaboration focuses on finding defects. But as people see things to improve, either they themselves note them, or somebody notes it, and then it could be, that could go to the designers, or it could be discussed later. Alas, it is not for congratulating web designers or developers. But clearly, it should know good features and bad features. Because otherwise, the designers may change the good features and leave the bad ones when they go to redesign. And what you do with the result, he points out, is you may say, well, this is a defect, and so be it. And redesigning, again, I want completely, I think design is too important to leave to designers alone. So users may have design suggestions. That's the whole idea of participatory design, that the designer then can take under advisement. And some design problems may cost a lot of money to correct. And so it has to be kicked up to the people who control the money to say, should we do this? And if it saves an e-commerce site, then you could say, well, if we fix this problem, it will cost us $50,000. And then, of course, the person who, the business person, who maybe owns the business, will say, what does it get me? Do I get 100 new customers each month? So how much new business do I get if I do this? And that will pause the kind of competition. So you may have to do a cost-benefit analysis of correcting the problem before deciding to actually do it. Right, the next slide on the numbers are cut off there. That would be slide 16. It defines what a usability defect is, right, if it found it. In the first is a clear departure from principles. For example, it's clearly poor contrast, which, by the way, I did not see in the web heuristics that they adopted from Nielsen, because in software evaluation that may not be a key point, but in website evaluation it's right up there on the top. And it's really a defect if it causes delays or confusion, so errors. If it's just something you don't like, if you don't like the colors, but they would not cause a delay, maybe there you go. However, there may be more things in what the usability defect, as in the user doesn't even stay at the site. So they take one look and they go on. And colors may have something to do with that. So this may be more than usability, it may be attractiveness, but it's something that needs to be looked at. So I think they later on have a form, but if you want to record for each thing, where on the web page is it, what's the defect, and the description, and what's being violated, that should have software support. I mean, remember the computer assisted usability systems engineer, I think is what they call it. It would be very helpful in that case if you could make a little circle or even a square around the area on the website that has a problem. And then you right click and a box pops up and it says description of the problem, principle violated. And if you don't remember the principles, you could right click on that and get a list of your principles from which you can select. So I'm designing usability assistant software on the fly. But that would clearly be, otherwise this can be fairly cumbersome. Could have a paper log and do it. And if you don't have software, you need to do it. They have their own list on slide 17 of web design principles. Good layout, visibility is what previously was called, talked as relying on recall, not unrecognition on a recall. Everything needed to complete the task is available. Feedback, users keep informed, that's for the active website. What was called consistency before is called reuse, but reusing visual elements clearly will get consistency. Simplicity. Now, tolerance, flexible and forgiving organization and interaction, what does that mean? And it gives you good error messages, I guess, and forgiving is probably part of that. I mean, it gives you easy ways to fix it.
And maybe if you may be able to accept several different likely inputs to respond.
That are both equally correct, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, if it's not making you jump through loops, it's just trying to figure out what you want.
So if you had, I mean, the simplest example, if you had a box where you can type in the state, and not one of these top-down menus, even except those MD and Maryland.
Caps
and non-caps and with any...
Maybe even correct a spelling error.
Right. Forgiving would be correcting spelling errors. Uh, So you have many lists of these design heuristics, usability heuristics. And they overlap, and sometimes they're the same thing, differently named. Sometimes they are, I mean, the structures, the layer is deliberate and makes sense to users in terms of their tasks, their intentions. That's something that was not spelled out like that in Nielsen, especially as I saw it. It's definitely useful for both software and websites. So slide 18 just gives the more about the inspection plan, and there is that's very similar to what Nielsen's list, a little shorter. Define user scenarios, arrange for equipment and material, the documentation, and select the team participants, assign roles. They correspond very much to the broad groupings he came up with from Nielsen's list. Okay, I think I'm going to jump a bit here to slide 20. Enacting use cases. So they have sort of a simulation. This is participatory design. You have a user and a developer work together. And so this is, say, a paper prototype. The user says, I press this button. The developer says, what happens? And what happens may be on the next piece of paper. Right? They look like that. So this is enacting a use case with paper. Be part of the design piece. If the website is already done and only to be evaluated, which is more the perspective that course is, would not happen. And you would have a user actually use it and go through it. I will leave the rest of you to you to have a look at. All right, so there is a, after the end of these slides, if you turn the page, there is a sample of usability recommendations from a different place. And so what they say, this is for an e-commerce website, and they say the pathway to order completion is too long. Too many pages and clicks. And it's not in the printed piece. I mean, not in the
food.com. The
machine readable price. It's the food.com. And then make specific recommendations as to where to move the button. Since we don't know the site, it's so sort of hard to exactly picture. But at one point, they recommend, instead of going to a different page, do a pop-up. So going to a different page and coming back is more confusing. So pop-up on the same page, it's easier on the user. That's one recommendation. And on the second recommendation is to make one page, even though it's long, no use of my head to scroll, rather than clicking to subsidiary pages. And presumably they found this by having some users go through it and observe them, and this is probably a result of detailed user testing and noting, I mean, not just finding out how many users get lost, but where they get lost and why. The next page illustrates something that's often done in design, where they create what is called a persona. So maybe it's even better seen from the next page. Actually, I think this may be a point at which my pages stuff off from being on the right side. So these are personifications of customers. And I'm on a page that's called Page McCormick. So they give these people names, and then they describe them in detail. It's an elementary art teacher, owns their own house, is a dog owner. Now you can see this is old here, has a 50s game modem, but I think after the DSL service, a lot smaller pet shops. And so then they will use these personas as sort of synthetic users. And somebody, some tester, will try to put himself or herself into the shoes, or better, what is it, the brain of that persona, and act like a person typified like that could. And so if you go to the previous page, they have a lot of different people that don't have names, but different types of users. Now, so I said one use of this is to impersonate those users, if you will. But another use is if you want to do assembled users for testing. And if you have some idea of the demographics of your present website, or the demographics of what you want to attract. So here you have a spectrum of the kind of users you want to attract to your website. So you will then find some actual, or tend to say specimens, some actual people that fit that description as users. And what follows are some forms that go along with that we're going to go through. So the next page, which is competitive analysis, that is an interview guide to interview users about their response to a website. Again, if it's e-commerce, you may run a number of subjects against a number of competitors' websites and collect the data that from here. And these are what is known as structured interviews. But you do have, they're not interviews run the gamut from completely free form, you have no agenda at all, you just talk to the person, to sort of administering a questionnaire by talking to the person and reading the question and getting the answers. I think the Gallup poll does that. They give from house to house and they're reading the question and they record the answers. So that's just that's essentially the same data collection as then made in the questionnaire, except you're sure you get responses. This is sort of in the middle, in that it doesn't give yes-no questions or that. But it does get some rating at the end. But so what your initial response is a site. So the person says something, well, I like the site, or I didn't like because I didn't like the colors, or I don't really care about it because it's too confusing, or whatever they, but it's completely free-form answer. The next question is a little more specific. What is your impression of the company's purpose? And you could adapt that question to many other websites. If it's a website to promote better environmental practices and habits.
Would this be used after like the person has, say, looked at it for 5 minutes and then you start the questions?
Yes.
Or is it more like, okay, so it's after the person has had their 5 minutes or...
Yes,
okay.
Yes. So, I mean, the scenario here, I would imagine, is they bring these people in to lab where they have the computers. And they show them one website, or they may have a number of people, and they may show them the website, and then they ask them these questions. Now, I just goes to me, what could you do just mechanically instead of bringing these people in?
Online.
Recruit those people. Yeah. They will call you at such times. So when you call them, would you please go onto this website? And then the caller loses 5 minutes, unfortunately. And then when they're done, you ask them the questions, and you know them down. List the services the site provides. So this is a questionnaire that will find out how quickly a user can sign up this web page. And clearly, the better his answers, the better is the site. And so that's actually, I mean, this is a way you could code those responses into some quantitative measurements. So that's performance measures, collecting data for performance measures. And then they rate ease of use, look and feel, navigation overall, and any additional comments people may have. The next page gives you a form. I'm not going to go over in great depth to make these user role models. And you could get a real person and collect these data and then from that abstract to, again, what they call the persona. Or you could just take this form and it will just tell you, it's a template for constructing personas. So it has a responsibility, specializes in, has other roles, general characteristics, salient background, what training, domain knowledge, what domains do they know, or if we look for a specific domain, it's just how much, interaction profile, information profile, how much do they know, are they mainly oriented towards oral input? Are they more oriented towards visual input? Can they do both? And there's a lot of things to get from users, and the back of that page has a similar form for task. Or what's known as use cases. Then you have another checklist of roles that actually has a little more than what we just looked at, because they are, it's a web user role checklist. And maybe we should look at that in a little more detail. These are characteristics of people that will influence their dealing with websites. And so it's an interesting list for that purpose. It can also be, of course, then used to put more detail on web interaction characteristics to a persona. So the balance is the positive or negative to a given site. But that would be site-specific. The others are not site-specific. General attitudes are they eager or skeptical or cautious or impatient or resentful. Those are characteristics of people generically. Are they easily emotional, easily frustrated, or are they generally happy? Does it say anywhere how tolerant they are to errors? Or not best way of doing things. I mean, the English expression is, do they suffer fools gladly? Applied to website, that's not on here, but that would also be an important characteristic. Likelihood of abandoning site. So, how long are they willing to put up with something? That's an interesting user characteristic. They may go off very, very quickly. It might, but some people are less patient than others.
I think they can be less patient than others on certain days than other days too.
That could well happen, yes. So again, this could be used to describe an actual interaction of somebody with a website. It could be used to describe a real person. It could be used to describe a imaginary person. And you could then look at a website and say, well, how likely would an impatient person be to stick with this? How likely would a patient person to stick with this? Maybe we don't care about impatient people. Maybe the message we have to give cannot be given to impatient person anyway. And so we're not going to, can't be changed. But for other things, maybe we need to. And this goes to simple things like how many clicks does it take? And it goes to how long is the response time? And even on the web, you sometimes get these long response times, and it depends partially also on the modem, of course. So if you know there are many impatient people out there, you want to pay particular attention to a general heuristic that was set for software about response time, and let the user know what's happening. And if you have to wait for 30 seconds for website to load, and only then you get any feedback. These days, many people would say, forget this, and click on the next Google result. If on the other hand there's something displayed, even if it just says please wait or Babel, this website could display some useful information quickly. And while the user stores this information, there has to be some. So that design heuristic would be related to the degree of impatience of the user. The rest of this observation, I think, is more the interaction information. Those are more for observing a specific web interaction. So this form, this web user role checklist, could be used as a checklist for an observer who observes people interacting with this website. And some of it, like domain knowledge, may require some question of the user to find out what domain knowledge they have. But if you collect 100 of these interactions, you could then have some sense of what is it with you? Stickiness. There's a term in web speak. Stickiness means how long do the users stay with your site. Of course, you want to send them, they actually bought something or do something. But if they leave for the first 5 seconds, it's not good. But having 100 of these collected could give you some good idea of what personality characteristics are involved in determining stickiness. Because the stickiness is in the action of the person with the site. And so there are site characteristics that matter, and there are person characteristics that matter. The next page, the web application usability defect log, that's a logging sheet that so it's all the, it's the pieces here. There, each row in this table is one defect, and so the locations are described somewhere by numbers. Location 0, or someplace else, it must say, it's located in the upper left-hand corner. They let you check off what interface feature is bad. So it could be animation, it could be a button, it could be a color, it could be a console, it could be dialogue. Could be a form, could be a frame, etc. Could be and it actually could be several of these combined. It could be the color of a form. And then they have a lot of problems. Awkward, complex, clever, confusing, distracting, error handling, hidden features, hidden behavior, inconsistent, missing, non-standard, uninformative. And furthermore, it could be related to the behavior. When you click a button, it could be related to feedback, to layout, to tolerance, to talk about visibility, workflow. And lastly, you are to say whether this is critical or major or minor or nominal. So this is a form where you can just circle or check what applies, and so you can very quickly record usability problems. Remember, I said that before, you need to have some way to log these or record them, and you need some form. And you might argue with the detail of the lists here, and you might revise them, but this may be good, as good as my interactive log, or maybe better, I don't know. I should try it out. But it's I mean, if I had to do, if these Cousin and Lockwood people are still in business, I would definitely consider them in evaluating the usability of my website. Because I seem to have, I mean, they have a good process, it was laid out in the slides, and they have that kind of forms to back up the process. And you need those forms, otherwise it's hard to do. And in some sense, it's like your checklist for your software that you're doing. Like Martel. All right. So actually, I think let's take a break now till 2 o'clock. And there isn't an hour. Am I right? I need to check my schedule. Right. And then we'll have a look at some of this other material I want to look through. But a lot of it is just is reading also, so we're not going to get through 50 pages in an hour. End of this lecture.